completely innocent journalist who exposed war crimes, torture, and corruption. His support grows. Hashtag Free Assange Now.
And for those who are following the case, they might remember that it's, of course, live with something of a verdict or a judgment expected when the courts reopen in January, I believe, of 2021. And that moves us on to our next story. Russian hackers, says Washington. Explain.
Well, it's quite a hilarious story that's been produced by the media here, in that they're accusing instantly Russian hackers of hacking into the U.S. Treasury and spying on U.S. federal agencies. However, even in these articles, you will read that the United States government has not officially announced that this was Russia. However, the media, you know, go on their claims of they always source unnamed U.S. officials, it's always unnamed, that are supposedly claiming this. And then we've got the hours and hours of anti-Russia smears all over the media. And still the claims that Donald Trump is somehow a Russian puppet, even though, of course, Donald Trump has been one of the hardest presidents in recent history on Russia. This is never enough for the U.S. media, and they continue to claim that Trump is somehow owned by Putin. And on top of that as well, what we're seeing is this sort of feeds into this new McCarthyism sort of era where you can't even defend Russia or China when clearly these allegations are false or they're unfounded. And it feeds into what we're seeing is really a new Red Scare that's happening. You know, we're trying to accuse Russia and China of everything bad in this world, in an attempt to justify sanctions and justify military aggression overseas.
So let me see if I get this wrong. On one hand, Trump is in the pocket of Putin, but on the other hand, the Russians are using cyber technology to attack Trump's institutions. That's an interesting one. The online reaction, please. I'm a little confused. I wonder if social media would clarify that for me.
Well, people seem to be very confused online as well. The first one we've got here is from a Twitter user who says, U.S. Treasury hacked yesterday, Google got down today. All the pieces are being set into motion for the 2020 grand finale. We've got another one here who says, the U.S. Treasury was hacked by a foreign government group. These implications are serious. Our first line of defense is a DHS agency called CISA. Its leadership was crippled after Trump fired Chris Krebs for saying the election was the most secure in American history. So a bit of criticism there of Trump, but seems to be all over the place on Twitter in terms of the criticisms and how people are interpreting this.
So who benefits from this?
Well, of course, they're trying to push Donald Trump as far right as possible when it comes to Russia, and they've succeeded in this, even if you look at his withdrawal from the short and long range missile treaties and what he's done. He's set the stage for perhaps a war in the future with somewhere like Venezuela because of this. So basically, the establishment, these neoliberals and neoconservatives, are getting all they want by claiming that Russia owns Trump, whilst Trump does all he can to prove that he's not owned by Russia, and, of course, is taking a hard line against Russia and sanctioning and doing everything he can to be as far right-leaning as possible.
Indeed, as if to say, look, I couldn't possibly be after this. Robert Inukesh, thank you so much, and, of course, thanks to you for staying the course with us. Stay safe.
Limelight. As President Donald Trump continues his vain attempt to overturn his election defeat, Republicans who refuse to go along are being hit with a coordinated campaign of intimidation, retaliation, and threats. That's what fired Trump appointee Chris Krebs alleged in his recent lawsuit. The article you're about to hear has been written by MSNBC journalist Charlie Sykes. The piece is titled, Trump's Bullying Campaign is Working. This lawsuit is trying to fight back. Stay with us for more of MSNBC editorial written by Charlie Sykes. President Donald Trump continues his vain attempt to overturn his election defeat. Republicans who refuse to go along are being hit with a coordinated campaign of intimidation, retaliation, and threats. That's what fired Trump appointee Chris Krebs alleged in his recent lawsuit. In the lawsuit filed against the Trump campaign, Chris Krebs argues that the attacks are part of an intentional plan to bully any Republicans who question Donald Trump's claims that the election was rigged, or who resist his campaign to nullify the election. In the end, Krebs may not win, but his lawsuit is a graphic warning about the danger of political violence and how it's already deforming Republican politics. As Donald Trump keeps pushing efforts to overturn the election results, he and his allies have only escalated their rhetoric. On Wednesday, 9th of December, Trump tweeted, "We will soon be learning about the word courage and saving our country. I received hundreds of thousands of legal votes more in all of the swing states than did my opponent. All data taken after the vote says that it was impossible for me to lose, unless fixed." It's not clear whether the tweet is meant to incite violence, but if the goal is to intimidate, it may be succeeding. Only a handful of Republican officials have pushed back against Donald Trump's baseless charges. The Republican Attorney General of 17 states are backing Texas's long-shot bid to have the Supreme Court nullify the election results in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. Another 106 Republican members of the House of Representatives signed onto an amicus brief backing Texas's attempt to overturn the election result. If other members of the GOP are appalled by the president's attempt at mass disenfranchisement, most of them aren't saying so. Chris Krebs thinks he knows why. Until recently, Chris Krebs was a director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, putting him in charge of ensuring the security of the election and countering cyber attacks and disinformation. After the vote, he and other officials vouched for the safety and integrity of the process, issuing a statement declaring that the vote was the most secure in American history, and that contrary to the false rumors then circulating, there was no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised. Upset that Chris Krebs challenged his narrative of fraud, Donald Trump fired him via a tweet, making him an immediate target of Trump World. During an appearance on Newsmax, Donald Trump ally Joseph DiGenova singled out Chris Krebs and called for him to be drawn and quartered, and taken out at dawn and shot. In his case against the Trump campaign, Newsmax and lawyer DiGenova, Chris Krebs alleges defamation, intentional infliction of emotional distress, aiding and abetting, and civil conspiracy. As a result of DiGenova's threats, Chris Krebs argues in the lawsuit, an angry mob immediately bombarded him with a barrage of death threats and harassment, which continues to this day. But Chris Krebs notes his isn't an isolated case. He alleges that Donald Trump and his media allies have launched a concerted campaign to discredit and defame dissenting Republicans by labeling them as traitors, cowards, liars, or similar terms to retaliate against them directly and to chill others from speaking out. Chris Krebs contends that the threats are central to the campaign to deter Republicans from breaking with Donald Trump, even as he stokes fear, hawked conspiracy theories, and essentially claimed a vast criminal conspiracy. Dynamic has played out around the country. In Pennsylvania, Donald Trump and his allies have attacked Republicans as cowards and traitors. In Arizona, Donald Trump alleged that the governor of Arizona, Doug Ducey, had betrayed the people of Arizona because he followed the law and certified the state's election results. In Georgia, Donald Trump attacked the governor and labeled Secretary of State for Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, an enemy of the people, because Raffensperger hadn't bowed to Trump's demands that the Georgia election results be thrown out so that he could be declared the winner in that state. But the most dramatic aspect of Chris Krebs's lawsuit is his allegation that Donald Trump is actively and intentionally fomenting violence. Throughout his term as president, Krebs alleges, Trump has often refused to condemn violence by his supporters or has equivocated on the subject. This, among other of Trump's conduct, has led many of his supporters to believe that they have his tacit support to commit acts of violence. During the run-up to the election, the lawsuit says, this toxicity reached its zenith. Chris Krebs cites the arrest of 13 members of the paramilitary group who are accused of having plotted to kidnap and murder Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a frequent target of Donald Trump's ire. Since the election, he writes, threats upon election officials have risen to unprecedented levels. Across the country, the New York Times has reported election officials and their staff have been bombarded with emails, telephone calls, and letters brimming with menace and threats of violence. The result of their service in a presidential election in which the defeated candidate's most ardent followers have refused to accept the election results. It may be working. In Pennsylvania, the majority leader of the state Senate described the pressure to sign a letter rejecting the state's election results. If I would say to you, I don't want to do it, said Senator Kim Ward, I'd get my house bombed tonight. Which brings us back to the Newsmax interview in which lawyer DeGenoa singled out Chris Krebs and called for his execution. Chris Krebs's lawsuit describes the evolving ecosystem of the right-wing media, the relationship among Donald Trump's campaign, Newsmax, and DeGenoa. Chris Krebs writes, is symbiotic. Newsmax disseminates and amplifies Donald Trump's claims of election fraud and the threats of allies like DeGenoa, the lawsuit continues, which pleases viewers, prompts endorsements from Donald Trump, increases ratings, supports the political goals of the defendant campaign, and helps raise more money from duped supporters. But it's also dangerous, Chris Krebs's lawsuit contends, that Trump and his allies hope to promote and encourage unlawful threats towards and actual violence upon Republicans like him for speaking the truth and performing his constitutional duties without regard to party loyalty. In great detail, Chris Krebs's lawsuit lays out the reaction of social media users on the right-wing site Parler after he was labeled a traitor. Some examples from comments posted on or around 1st of December included a user who said he had put himself in the line of fire. We know now that he did lie when he said there had been no cyber interference with the election. Under this evidence alone, he should be tried for treason and shot as a traitor. Why waste a bullet? Just smash his head in with rocks, another user said. If we make an example of one of these traitors, then we might get rid of all of the rats that are still hiding in the darkness, a third intoned. Around 24 such messages were included in the filing. All of this took a predictable toll. The lawsuit said the unrelenting fear that Chris Krebs experienced after learning of DeGenoa's threats has been staggering. His fears were shared by his family, including his 10-year-old boy, who piercingly asked, "Daddy's going to get executed?" Chris Krebs notes that it's a question no parent should ever hear or have to answer, but it's a haunting warning of what happens to a political party when blind loyalty replaces principle and when conformity is enforced by intimidation and even threats of violence.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Maybe we can say that, like any other successful person in the world, the first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great efforts.
My method of tafsir is Quran by the Quran.
We have in the Quran that if you do everything for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and if you have a divine cause, and you follow that divine cause, Allah make you famous. Generally, we have people who go after the popularity, for example, through their like books and the works that they do. But Allama, one of the main characteristics was that he was doing everything for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists all across the nation of Islam. And with me in the studio are two experts, two religious experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Rezazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, brother. And Dr. Murtaza Rezazadeh, thank you very much, brother, and assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
From today onward, we want to talk about a personality who is considered one of the most prominent thinkers in the modern Shia Islam, and he had expertise in different fields of studies. He was a polymath, in fact, and his comprehensive personality made him one of the greatest trainers, teachers, and philosophers of contemporary Iran, and not only Iran, in the world of Islam. And he is no one but Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai, mainly known as Allama Tabatabai. Allama, in fact, is an honorific title used for a polymath in Farsi and Arabic language. So for today's discussion, we want to listen to one of his Farsi audio file along with the English translation, and then we'll get to the elaboration by the scholars over here. Let's listen to that and we'll be back.
روش ما همین تفسیر قرآن به قرآن توضیحش همین دیگه قرآن.
My method of tafsir is Quran by the Quran. The reason for this is because the Quran is a divine book. Its divine and definite characteristics make it so the contents resolve themselves. Meaning all the contents and subjects of the Quran, when taken into consideration, are addressed with exactness and give explanations by the verses themselves. This is the system and procedure I have used in my tafsir of the Quran by the Quran.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This was the voice of Allama Tabatabai talking about his method of the exegesis of the Holy Quran. We know that Allama Tabatabai in the Islamic world is known for his exegesis on the Holy Quran, known as Tafsir al-Mizan. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's get to you, brother. So what made the Tafsir al-Mizan of Allama Tabatabai different from the other exegesis of his time? And this method that he's explaining, Quran as explained by the Quran, what is it exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously, Allama Tabatabai have spent his 17 years of his life in writing this exegesis on the Quran, which is known as Tafsir al-Mizan.
Right.
So it's better to use the word Tafsir because we are
more
used to with this word, al-Mizan.
Yes.
And it took him 17 years, where there's a famous saying by Ayatollah Khoi, Abu al-Qasim Khoi, that he said that Allama Tabatabai has sacrificed his ijtihad or marja'iyyat, being a scholar who issues a fatwa and gives the rulings. He sacrificed this duty for the Quran.
He was not known as a marja, no?
Allama Tabatabai is not known as a marja.
Okay.
Why? Because he spent his life as the tafsir of Quran, but he is known as Allama.
Allama.
There is another point that Allama is called to a person who is above marja'iyyah.
Yeah. Okay.
This is a common point which we are not basically focusing on this.
Yes.
Generally, you know, in the Indo-Pak, you can say culture, they call a general like scholar as Allama.
Allama.
Whereas Allama, in its true meaning, when the big scholars like Ayatollah Marashi, Ayatollah Khoi, and all the other scholars, when they call him as Allama, It means that he have command over many
fields,
you can
of,
say,
studies.
Fields of studies,
right.
And he is on a higher rank than them in this sense.
Yes, yes.
So that's why he was known as Allama, but he wasn't famous as
Marja
or Ayatollah.
Everywhere they know him as Allama.
As
right.
Allama.
So when you get to this tafsir of Al-Mizan, this Allama doing a tafsir, what does it mean? What does it show?
It shows that obviously Allama, he did this tafsir. There was a lack of one of the tafsirs.
Okay.
As in one of the previous, I think, episodes you played, the voice of Ayatollah Marashi.
Yes.
In which he said, there are two tafsir of the Amma, like from the Ahl Sunnah,
yes.
But they haven't done the good job.
Yes.
And this thing, which Allama Tabatabai has done, was a really good job. And he basically... he has fulfilled the, we can say, like the criteria for which we can say, like, he has this tafsir, the verse to verse. Now, what does this mean, like doing the tafsir verse to verse? It means that in order to explain a verse, he was bringing a couple of verses for that. And through Quran, he tried to explain what does it mean. For example, if we have a verse, the other verses are supporting this thing. They are also explaining. But obviously, when we talk about the other verses,
okay.
There is a sha'n nuzul, for example.
Yes.
Like why this verse was revealed. It goes back to the history.
Yes.
Someone might say, like, Allama has said some part of history over here.
Yes.
But that history even goes back to the part of the verse. He has used the philosophical, you can say, like, the teachings.
Teachings, that's right.
The theological. He used the logical things. But obviously, all of them were under the umbrella of Quran.
That's right.
And that's how he used. But his main focus was obviously explaining the words of Quran through Quran.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Okay, Dr. Rezazadeh. So in order to, for an alim or a scholar, in order to do a scientific work, you know, some, we can say, theories are needed and some background. I mean, the methodology of Allama Tabatabai, I'm sure, has roots in some, we can say, basic tenets. What are those tenets, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, we have different methods in interpretation, I mean, in the commentary of the Quran. A very common way of finding out the meanings or interpreting the meanings of the Quran is what we call traditional way, or, I mean, based on the traditions or the hadith that we have from the
okay.
Prophet, and in the Shi'i world from the Imams. So, and that is one of the very common ways, and we have several tafsirs. So the commentator brings the verse of the Quran and finds out some of the traditions that has been narrated from the Prophet or from the Ahlul Bayt in the Shi'i world to explain the meaning of that. The other approach that we can have to the Quran is the rational approach. So we look at the verse and we find out based on the different criteria and the context and the history and a lot of different principles, but without necessarily a lot of, you know, putting a lot of emphasis on the traditions.
That's right.
Another method of the Quran that has been in use by the scholars from the big, I mean, from centuries ago, and that is what we call tafsir al-Quran bil-Quran, interpretation of the Quran by Quran, or
okay.
commentary of the Quran by Quran, and that is a contextual interpretation
okay.
based on other verses of the Quran that the commentator finds them related to the verse that he wants to explain.
Okay.
So according to what Allama says, and he explained in his words in this...
The audio file
that you played, he says, when you look at every single verse of the Quran, you find out some other verses that are somehow related to this verse, but not necessarily located close by that verse.
Okay.
So you may find them in other chapters
yes.
of the Quran, and it is up to the commentator to find them out.
Uh-huh.
And it needs a lot of research and
okay.
a lot of reflection
yes.
on all the different verses of the Quran, and it needs a lot of mastery to the Quran as a whole, so you know that
uh-huh.
what the Quranic verses in general
right.
are talking about,
yes.
and then you are able to find out another verse
uh-huh.
that explains the current verse that you
it
have
needs,
the question.
It needs lots of taking notes, because on that time there was no search engines.
Sure.
Nowadays, in the whole Quran, in the different softwares, you can find, for example, even the topical interpretation exists of the Holy Quran exists the numerical, the topical, alphabetical, okay, different
Absolutely, different, yes.
formats. And by a simple search on the software, you can find, for example, different verses of the concept of, for example, Jannah in the Holy Quran. But on that time, for Allama, in order to find different verses which are contextually close to each other and explain them through each other, that was very difficult. Was it only the only method? I mean, no history or a hadith?
No, 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 that's not the case. Actually, some people have this misunderstanding that when Allama Tabatabai says, I am interpreting the Quran by the Quran, that's the only means that he's using, and that is not the case, actually. He wants to say that his main approach or his main method in doing interpretation is to give priority to other verses of the Quran, but this never means that he does not use other methods, because they are absolutely, I mean, rationally necessary for a person. For example, if a person does not know the history of the revelation of
certain verses
or the other context around a verse, or even the traditions that we have had from the Prophet and the Imams about the verse, that the person will not be able to look at the verse. And when you referred, you know, these days we have the book with us, and we can refer to Al-Mizan now and see what he has done. We see that Allama, in addition to doing a lot of Quran to Quran interpretation, he also looks at the riwayat, he also looks at the rational argumentations, and a lot of other methods that
he
uses.
Quran to Quran, okay? Maybe both of them.
And you know, it is it is also highly based on hadith that we have from Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, that says al-Quran yufassiru ba'duhu ba'dah. We have a hadith from Imam Ridha that says the Quran, some parts of the Quran interprets the other parts of the Quran, and that has become a foundation for this method of interpretation.
So Sayyid Mohsen, do you agree what Dr. Reza Sadat said regarding the methodology of Allama in exegesis?
Yes, I think what Dr. Rizazadeh has mentioned is true. And for those who generally criticize and they say like this tafsir is not the tafsir like verse to verse or ayah to ayah.
Yeah, there are some criticisms.
There are some criticism. Yeah. For them, the answer is obviously it is very easy to criticize something rather than doing something.
Okay.
It's very easy to criticize because Allama has spent his 17 years of his life in order to do this. And in his, obviously in tafsir, when you look at the tafasir, when you read an ayah, he first tries to bring the verses. And then after that, he brings the other evidences as the narrations or the intellectual discussions or the reasoning that are available there or the historical or maybe theological discussions
That's
that he had. So on the first place, he brings the verses, and then after that, he brings other evidences as well. Now, in some cases, because each and every verse, it's very hard, and it's the first time that I think amongst the Shia and Sunni we can say like Allama was the first who came up with this type of tafsir, this 20 volumes tafsir, and at this scale that he could, he did his best, and it's very easy to criticize this. Rather than criticizing, we should, like those who criticize, they should come up with the proper
solution. Understanding,
that's you know, in every subject we have this, in every subject some people, they come and they contribute something. And that's the first step. It's the duty of the others to
complete it
or to continue the journey that they have started. So in this regard, in regards to the tafsir, there are some specifications of this tafsir. Number one, it is the sequential and the subjective as well. Allama has combined two things in this. One, sequential exegesis of the Quran.
That's right.
Which is the tafsir and interpretation of the Quran. It's sequential. It starts from the first chapter till 114. It goes sequentially.
Yes.
Number two, he also tried to focus on the different topics that are coming within the obviously interpretation.
Yes.
Number two, he had the unity in the topics. For example, if he has chose a couple of verses and he wanted to interpret them, there was a unity among those. Obviously, the verses and the surahs that we have, they have a whole, or they can, we can say like they have one theme, a main theme.
Main theme.
So he kept that main theme. He did not go out of that.
So it is also a thematic interpretation.
Yes, it was. Okay. It is. And also, obviously, the very most important, we can say like characteristics of this tafsir was that he did it verse to verse. He brought verses.
Okay.
as it is mentioned before.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Said Mohsen Naghvi and Dr. Rezazadeh. For our dear listeners in the English language, another Allama or Ayatollah Said Said Akhtar Rezvi, who is known for his great works in the, we can say, Tanzania, and also his current son, I mean Sayyid Muhammad Rezvi, have translated Al-Mizan into English language, and the English is really perfect. He translated it into English language, Ayatollah Sayyid Said Akhtar Rezvi.
He did six volumes,
yes.
Has come in 10 volumes.
10 volumes, yeah, has come in 10 volumes, but the English translation was, as long as he was alive, he translated it into English language, Ayatollah Sayyid Said Akhtar Rezvi. And it is available also, both in printed and also software. It was very kind of you, Dr. Rezazadeh and Said Mohsen Naghvi. We talked about Al-Mizan, exegesis of the Holy Quran, as done by Allama Tabatabai. And as Ayatollah Marashi Najafi said about this exegesis and this man, this is really an honor for the Shia world, that such a scholar like Allama Tabatabai who could do this great work. Dear listeners, also thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, or our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and since Jamadi al-Awwal is the month of the birthday of the Holy Prophet's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, we present you a wonderful saying from her husband, Abdullah ibn Ja'far al-Tayyar, regarding the noble daughter of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon them, who cared for the comforts and ease of her brothers and sister, was generous to the poor, to the homeless, and to the parentless. Zainab is the best housewife.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/EN.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum, and so welcome to this program, today's special. Our topic is about the concept of wealth in Islam. We invite you to listen to today's special.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, حقق آمانينا وفقنا في كل آن فيما سعينا. Ya Allah, Ya Mannan, حقق آمانينا وفقنا في كل آن فيما سعينا. Grateful today for difference and change, for all colors and shades, 'cause you made it this way. وهبتنا النبراس في حب كل الناس أغدق لنا إحساس أنت هادينا.
Today, Wednesday, is the first of Jamadi al-Awwal, 1442 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 26th of Azar, 1399 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 16th of December, 2020 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We'll listen to the Holy Quran, chapter Tawbah, verse 34.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. يا أيها الذين آمنوا إن كثيرا من الأحبار والرهبان ليأكلون أموال الناس بالباطل ويصدون عن سبيل الله والذين يكنزون الذهب والفضة ولا ينفقونها في سبيل الله فبشرهم بعذاب أليم.
O you who have believed, indeed many of the scholars and the monks devour the wealth of people unjustly and avert them from the way of Allah. And those who hoard gold and silver and spend it not in the way of Allah, give them tidings of a painful punishment.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The mentioned holy verse has clearly prohibited treasuring up wealth and commands Muslims to utilize their properties actively in the way of Allah and in a profitable path for Allah's servants. They should severely avoid treasuring and storing them in a corner so that their wealth would not be applied in the current bargains. Otherwise, they must wait for a painful punishment.
Yourself, can't you see this wonder spread in front of you? The clouds floating by, the sky so clear and blue, planets in their orbits, the moon and the sun, such perfect harmony. Let's start questioning ourselves, isn't this proof enough for us?
Now, concept of wealth. In Islam, wealth does not hold a central position in the social matrix. Instead, It has been visualized as an instrument to lead life in accordance with the Sharia. The real objective of man's existence on this earth is to obey the commandment of Allah and to implement His will as His vicegerent. The resources of worldly life constitute necessary facilities and instruments for carrying out this mission. They are not desirable as an end in themselves, only as a means, even essential means. Therefore, there is little point in entering into a fanatic race for amassing riches of the world. The significance of the worldly resources and their instability has been stated in the Quran and Hadith at several places. The fundamental idea is that the attainment of wealth should not be the focus of all activities in this world. Instead, wealth should be acquired, preserved, and used to attain a higher level in the obedience of Allah. This is a major point of departure from the Western concept of wealth, where economic pursuits have come to occupy a central place in the life of the individual and the state. This does not mean that Islam dislikes and discourages economic pursuits. Islam places an equal emphasis on a struggle and enterprise in worldly life. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi-nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to talk about wealth in Islam. One cannot say whether wealth is good or bad. It depends on the application, to which wealth may be put. One of companions of the sixth infallible Imam, Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, inquired him regarding a piece of hadith in that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam once indicated that in case a noble person has come to you, respect him, and noble means sharif. And then this companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, whose name was Jamil ibn Durraj, asked Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about the meaning of the word sharif or noble. And then Imam Sadiq alayhi salam answered him that in that context, sharif or noble means a person who has got adequate wealth and properties. So those people who have a better social position, they must be respected, not because of their social position, but because they've been accustomed to a much easier life, a much easier type of life, and because of this, they expect everybody to respect them. At the same time, we find that even in the conduct of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he had some guests who were from the noble classes of community, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam respected them in such a way that the nobility made them expect such kind of kind treatment.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone.
Essential Islamic teachings on wealth. Remember this: do not fear poverty. Allah will provide.
In the time before Islam, the pagans would kill their children in the fear of poverty. After Islam was introduced, the companions who used to practice this tradition began to abstain from it. As in the Holy Quran, chapter 6, verse 151, Allah says, "Do not kill your children out of poverty. We will provide for you and them." Dear Muslim, you know God is the provider of all. A true believer should not fear poverty because Allah will provide for them. Some believers say that fearing poverty is the same as not trusting in God.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, a day you'll always remember every part.
Today's a special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
We look at tips for simplify our spending in this part. Avoid buying unless you've got the money. It's this very attitude that promoters of the credit card seek to change. They want you to think that this silly piece of plastic is the ticket of happiness. It means you can buy when, where, and how you want. Not true. Remember, if you buy on credit, you will have to deal with the stress of paying off this bill before the interest kicks in. If you don't, the original piece will keep increasing. Not only is this a headache, taking and paying interest is haram.
So I spend my entire life chasing after the dunya and I want more and more and more. I can never rest. I can never quench that thirst. The Prophet says the only time you will quench your thirst, the only time you will see that person settling in, and you know, retiring, is when he is placed in his grave, at turab, when he is placed under the dust. And here, you know, when they bury someone, they write on his tombstone three letters, R.I.P. What does that mean? Rest in peace. Do you know why? Because before this day, there was no rest. There was always dunya, 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 money, money, money. All we do our lives, we chase after the dunya. Finally, we rest today that we are in our place in our graves. That's why they write R.I.P. Because before this day, there was no rest. Finally, now I can rest because I can't chase after the dunya. Because dunya has finished. This is how life is. So this obsession that sometimes we develop, brothers and sisters, sometimes it becomes very harmful. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he speaks about this. When he went on his journey to Karbala and he spoke to his ashab, one of the most beautiful and profound things he said in his sermon, he said, "An-nas abidu dunya." He said, human beings, they worship this dunya. They don't worship God. And when they say, La ilaha illallah, when they say, they claim they worship God, it's only fake words that they are saying through their tongue. Their true devotion and dedication is not for God, it's for the dunya, it's for materialism. Just look at this world and how obsessed we've become with materialism and with money and with our desires.
Dear friends, thank you for being with us till this part and part of today's special. We were speaking about wealth in Islam. Inshallah, we'll continue on another episode of today's special. So don't forget us on IRIB English Radio, today's special. Have a nice time.
Sometimes I can't see where I'm supposed to go. Sometimes I speed up when I should take it slow. But through all my hard times, when I lose my way, you're concealing my mistakes. Yeah, I know you're always by my side, never turning out your light. When I need you most, your stars will shine. When I'm out there in the darkest place, worn and tired, I can still see you illuminate all my skies. When it feels like I've fallen too far from you, there you are, guiding me through.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.